This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
We've all been in those public forums, speeches, dare I say sermons, or even movies that seemed to last too long. But when the conclusion was obvious or coming, we were given hope that we might very well reach the end. We might survive that moment. And in some ways, that may be how we feel about the book of Ecclesiastes, a book that began with a simple question: what gain is there from toil done under the sun? That was the question way back in chapter 1, verse 3, has mounted a significant amount of wisdom for our lives. And at times it's perplexing wisdom. We're not quite sure what God's up to in the midst of this. I think Ray Ortland said it best when he said, "One reason for our angry frustration in our world is that we aren't reading Ecclesiastes. We keep expecting everyone to be smart and reasonable. The reality, though, is that there's vanity all around us. There's meaninglessness. There's soap bubbles all around us. Vanity." And again, Ray makes us wonder. We might think that when X happens, I'll finally arrive. But what if X does happen? It's going to let you down. And Ecclesiastes warns us of this. So vanity of vanities, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And as we come to the end of this book, this is going to be uttered again, right? Right before the passage we're going to read here to kind of wrap up here. We're going to get that again. So in light of that, what is the end of the matter? What do we build our lives on? How do we live in light of this? And again, as we think about Thanksgiving this week, so there's a lot of things coming together, like Thanksgiving and all that's happening. Ecclesiastes is going to help steady us in this vain world that we live in. What makes our lives worthwhile is not our impact on the world, which is fleeting, but our origin in God, who's good. This book teaches us to value our work, to value our toil, not for its outcome, that'd be vanity, but for its source, and that's God. And thus, this book is really driving us to gratitude, to see that we need something beyond ourselves. So what I hope emerges as we wrap up this book today is that you would see how we're drawn up to fear God, awing Him for who He is, that awe of God would be built into you. We're going to be called to fear God again in these passages. And as we see this, I hope it provokes gratitude within us as well. So what are some lessons that stand out to you in this book? So again, this is the sixth week. We began examining 6 weeks ago our toil and seeing that our work under the sun leaves us empty. That when we build our lives just for work, for toil, it's going to leave us empty. And then we continued investigating our toil, and we began to see that God must be a part of all that we do under the sun. When we give ourselves to pursue all kinds of pleasure at His expense, we're going to be left empty. And then in the middle sections of the book, God provided us wisdom for time and life. That was chapters 3 and 4. Then we teased out some implications of His sovereignty over creation and how this affects our lives in chapters 5 through 7. That we're called to live in reverence to God, that we're to live properly related to wealth, we're to do what's good, and we're to be aware how sin gets in the way of living the way we should. And then last time, we were given incentives to fear God with joy, and when the writer of Ecclesiastes gives us an incentive, it's not like the incentives of this world. Like, you know, it's not like my bank saying, "Hey, you know, give us more money and we'll give you $100 for another checking account or something." It's not an incentive like that. The incentive to fear God with joy for the writer of Ecclesiastes is like, you're going to die. So live right now. Live. So that's where we were last week. So where are we headed? What's the end of the matter? What's this all building to by way of conclusion? That's what we're trying to answer today. And I hope this book and its message has affected the way that you live. The priority here at the end of the book, at the end of the matter, is going to be a proper relationship with God. This is going to lead to our walking in wisdom, prioritizing Him in our days on earth, and heeding His words for us. So this is where we're going to end up today. And on one level, once again, the point of the Bible is to draw you away from yourself to God. This is maybe one of the big storylines of the Bible, that the Bible is consistently inviting you to Look away from yourself to God. This is the problem all the way back in the garden, right? The serpent tempts Eve and says, did God really say? You know, it's like, you're smart enough to figure this out. You don't need no God in your life. You can do this on your own. And that problem continues over and over and over again. And what the writer says here at the end is, look away from yourself to God. So we get locked up in so many tendencies and even sins that distort or misrepresent what God thinks of us. We drift into thinking that we're too bad for God. Or we even think that we have to get things in order before we could have a relationship with Him. I had an interaction with someone this week that was kind of, that was the case for them. You know, God must really hate me because He's kind of exposed the sin in my life. And I said, no, God loves you. He spared you from that. Someone who was giving his life to an addictive lifestyle, something that was going to tear and mess up his life. And it had messed up his life before, and he was tempted to go back into that again. And I said, God loves you. He's come after you. I just kind of said something in joking, and then it all ended up drifting into this. So we drift into thinking this way all the time. I mean, you might think, oh, I'm better than this. You know, how much longer is God going to put up with me? All these things run through our minds. And all the while, God's inviting us closer. He's saying, come on, come close to me. Let's relate to one another. Let's have a relationship. He's calling us to fear Him. He's calling us to reverence Him. He's calling us to awe Him. And we lose that. We awe all the things that are vanity. We reverence all the things that are vanity, right? Like nobody's going to dare get into my time because that's sacred. We awe that. We reverence things that serve us and our selfish interests. And God's calling us away from this dumpster fire. We don't recognize it's a dumpster fire, but He's calling us away from that to Him. And so today, as we conclude this book, we're going to see a call to listen to God. So will you listen to Him today? Will you just perk your ears and say, God, what do you have today? What are you saying? Will you lean in to hear His heart for you? He wants you to fear Him. He wants you to relate to Him. He wants you to reverence Him. Or are you going to lean back into yourself and say, I don't need anybody telling me how to live. I can do this on my own. I'm smart enough. I can figure this out. So give yourself here at the end of this book that your life might have some sort of direction. And so I invite you to join me as we see three concluding exhortations from the preacher. And let's read Ecclesiastes 12, 9 to 14. So this is the proper conclusion. This is called the epilogue. And if you look up just at verse 8, right? Look at chapter 12, verse 8. There it is again. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. And then he gets into verse 9. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. These words of the wise are like goads and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. And they're given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. This is God's word. Thanks be to God. So three concluding exhortations. And so we're going to get there. We're going to get back to this passage in just a second. But go back with me to chapter 10, verse 1. Chapter 10, verse 1. The first concluding exhortation begins back here in chapter 10. And it comes as we see that wisdom is preferable to foolishness. I know this just seems like an obvious point to many of us in this room. Like, of course, wisdom is better than foolishness. But this is kind of, as the writer begins to turn the corner to kind of land the plane, he wants to land this as one of the reasons, one of the concluding exhortations, that wisdom is better than foolishness. So this section really sounds a lot more like the book of Proverbs than Ecclesiastes. And it's all to show that wisdom is better than foolishness. So let me read that, beginning in verse 1 of chapter 10. Here's what he reads. Dead flies make the perfumer's ointment give off a stench, so a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. A wise man's heart inclines him to the right, but a fool's heart to the left. Even when the fool walks on the road, he lacks sense, and he says to everyone that he is a fool. If the anger of the ruler rises against you, don't leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. There is an evil that I've seen under the sun, as it were an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in many high places, and the rich sit in a low place. I've seen slaves on horses and princes walking on the ground like slaves. He who digs a pit will fall into it, and a serpent will bite him who breaks through a wall. He who quarries stones is hurt by them, and he who splits logs is endangered by them. If the iron is blunt, and one does not sharpen the edge, he must use more strength, but wisdom helps one to succeed. If the serpent bites before it's charmed, there's no advantage to the charmer. The words of the wise man's mouth win him favor, but the lips of a fool consume him. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is evil madness. A fool multiplies words, though no one knows what is to be, and who can tell him what will be after him? The toil of a fool wearies him, for he does not know the way to the city. So these first 15 verses of chapter 10, he's trying to make the case that wisdom is better than foolishness, and he's doing that by showing us that life is uncertain. So in verse 1, we're warned to not allow wisdom to be tainted by folly. A little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. And so we're not to make any mistake about it. The lives of the wise and the foolish look differently. It is consequential. We shouldn't act as if the sky is falling, in verse 4, as if a ruler is angry with us. We shouldn't run. We shouldn't leave that place. Calmness will steady us in these tense moments. And then in verses 5 through 7, there's an evil pointed out that fools are given honor and rich can be humiliated. Whether high or low, a ruler can make sloppy decisions that boggle the mind. I mean, that's happened before, right? You've been working for someone and they've made a foolish decision and you're like, don't they know? Yeah, it's going to happen. Life is uncertain. That's the whole point that the writer's making here. It doesn't matter what kind of position they have. It doesn't matter if they're high or low. They're going to make a decision. It's going to boggle our mind at times. And so as verses 8 and 9 show, cause and effect don't always line up. We can't predict what's going to happen. We can't predict, well, just because this thing should happen, it's going to happen. Sometimes the most normal things of life, like splitting logs, ends up causing us great danger. So it's just wild. Digging a pit, splitting logs can mean we're endangered by them. But this confusion of cause and effect doesn't mean that we should be sloppy in our work. We should sharpen the edge of the blade. So keep sharp edges on iron and work wisely, especially with snake charming, if that's your thing. So, you know, yeah. Copperheads are still crawling on the ground in Illinois, I've heard, just this morning, even in this bitter cold. So work smart. And finally, in verses 12 through 15, our attention is turned to foolish speech. Wise speech leads to favor, but foolish words can consume you. Foolish speech can lead to madness. Words are multiplied and compounding the uncertainty of life. That's the point he's making. You should live wise, but life's going to be uncertain in the midst of that. There's toil here that wearies him, because for all the yapping, you can't even know which way is home after work. So this is just wild stuff. The toil of the fool wearies him, for he does not know the way to the city. He doesn't even know the way home, because his toil wearies him. Wisdom is preferable to foolishness then, because life is uncertain. There's going to be things in life, and we're all going to scratch our heads and go, I don't know about that. But you should probably be wise in the midst of that. It's not a reason to just be foolish. And that's all the writer's trying to say. And on top of this, things might go differently. Evil may come your way. So look at verse 16. Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. Happy are you, O land, when your king is the son of the nobility and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. Through sloth, the roof sinks in, and through indolence, the house leaks. Bread's made for laughter, and wine gladdens life, and money answers everything. Even in your thoughts, don't curse the king, nor in your bedroom curse the rich, for a bird of the air will carry your voice, or some winged creature tell the matter. Cast your bread upon the waters, for you'll find it after many days. And give a portion to 7 or even to 8, for you know not what disaster may happen on earth. So there's a woe or a happiness contrasted in verses 16 and 17. There's a proper time and a proper place for feasting, right? So have you ever been in the home of someone who drinks a lot and then they break out like some alcohol for breakfast and you're like, hang on a second, you know, I'm not the sharpest tool in the drawer here, but isn't this a bit much? Like breakfast is not the time when most people get sloppy drunk. That's the point he's making, right? It's just like ill-timed. It's ill-timed feasting. You know, I guarantee you this Thursday, most of you are not going to have like a breakfast buffet. It's building up to lunch, right? I mean, it's building up to dinner. I mean, that's the writer's point here. There's a time and a proper place for feasting. It's at the proper time with restraint that's wise. That's what he's making in verses 16 and 17. Then in verse 18, it's like laziness can lead to disaster. Sloth and indolence lead to a leaky house without a roof. That sounds lovely, doesn't it? My house doesn't have a roof and it leaks. You want to come over? And you're like, wait a second, get to work, get a roof on that thing. You know, it's through laziness and sloth. Verse 19 reminds us that life, even money, is to be enjoyed. So, I mean, it's enjoy life. He's back to that theme. Bread's made for laughter. Wine gladdens life. Money answers everything. There's a great proper place for all these things. But if you have a ruler that overdoes the excess, a ruler who's maybe lazy or a ruler who goes beyond the enjoyments that are given, be careful in your criticism because it's going to turn back and bite you. That's the warning of verse 20. Evil may come your way. And then turning to chapter 11, we're encouraged to take risks because they may benefit you. Cast your bread upon the waters. You'll find it after many days. There's a benefit in taking a risk there. And then in verse 2, there's a call to be generous. And we're to be generous because hardship may come. You don't bank on the future to be generous. I mean, this is kind of the old gambler's wage, right? You know, the pot is so big now. Now's the time to pull the trigger, you know, and if I won the lottery, I'd be the most generous person there is. No, you wouldn't, not if you're not a generous person now. That's the point. That's the writer's point here, right? The time to be generous, if you have the money to be generous, is now. Not like some future day when you're going to be able to be more generous. You don't know what's going to happen then. Disaster may come upon you at that point. You're going to have to use your money in other ways. So be generous today. That's the point he's making in verse 2. Don't bank on the future to be generous because there may be a time when you're not be able to be generous because some disaster is going to come and evil may come your way. So the whole point of all this is just use wisdom today. Use wisdom today. Not only because life is uncertain, that was chapter 10, but because evil may come. You might have a ruler that's a bonehead. You might have some circumstance that comes your way. Use wisdom today. And then kind of the final point of this is in verses 3 through 6. We should be characterized by wisdom because God dispenses good mysteriously. Look at verse 3 of chapter 11. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. And if a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. He who observes the wind will not sow, but he who regards the clouds will not reap. As you don't know the way the Spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you don't know the work of God who makes everything. In the morning, sow your seed, and at evening, withhold not your hand, for you don't know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. So, I mean, do you see how just the feel of this is, chapters 10 and 11, this all just feels differently than what we've read in Ecclesiastes. It's almost like, okay, I'm getting ready to land the plane here, but on my way out, let me just throw some proverbs your way so that you can figure life out. And here the point is that, back up in verse 3, we should use these calls to be, sometimes we use calls to be risky or generous, like in verses 1 and 2, to our advantage. But then God allows things for all kinds of reasons. Like he allows clouds to give rain, but trees may fall for no reason. So it's almost like, you know, what I thought when I read verse 3 was like, oh, so that's, if a tree falls in the woods and no one's there to hear it, what happens? That's the biblical answer, right? If a tree falls to the north or south, wherever it falls, that's where it lays. Oh, yeah. So good to know. You know, just so helpful. The Bible's so practical like that. Trees may fall for no reason. I mean, they just fall. In whichever direction they fell, that's where they lay. And then verse 4 warns us to not stare like a deer in the headlights at things that we can't control, right? He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. Don't be paralyzed by these things and not end up doing anything. Looking to the wind and the clouds means that you're not sowing and reaping. And the point here then in verse 5 and 6 is that we don't know what God's up to. God acts mysteriously. He's working to make everything happen in his way. God's at work, and you can't predict it. So work hard. Sow seed. Be generous. Prepare yourself to prosper and do good in the path that honors God. Wisdom is preferable to foolishness. I mean, this is just a simple argument. But again, the writer just... we're not used to this kind of Eastern way of thinking, proverb kind of writing. I mean, we're just kind of direct, like, you didn't have to use all those words, you could have just told me. Yeah, but there's cultures where all those words helps them get the point. And there's probably some of us in this room that we just need more words to get the point. If I said to you, just act wise, stupid, or something, you know, something like that, you know, you'd be like, oh yeah, okay. And you, well, I'm not quite sure about this. But now that you've plotted through the biblical argument here, yeah, I really should be wise. I should pursue that because there's going to be evil days that come because life is so uncertain and because God acts so mysteriously. This is the way you should live. This is the writer's first aspect of concluding here. Secondly, there's another exhortation. And I think here, now we're moving from Proverbs to kind of things we can kind of sink our teeth into. Another exhortation here is to steward your youth in light of your mortality. This begins in verse 7. Steward your youth in light of your mortality. One writer calls this section a cosmic funeral. You're going to see that in a second. The idea is that the preacher's been calling us to take advantage of the life that we've been given to live. And this section begins with a call to rejoice. So begin reading in verse 7 with me. Follow along with me in verse 7 of chapter 11. Light is sweet. It's pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. So if a person lives many years, let him rejoice in all of them. But let him remember that the days of darkness will be many. All that comes is vanity. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. Remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body. For youth and the dawn of life are vanity. So again, he just can't quite write in like the perfectly positive way. He's just got to give all these caveats like, okay, yeah, so rejoice in your youth because God's going to judge it all. And enjoy God fully with your heart, because it's all vanity. You know, so he's just, this is the way the writer is. But the call here is to rejoice in your youth. The eyes enjoy light. And many years on this earth should lead you to much rejoicing. The oldest people in life should be the ones who have rejoiced the most. But the reality is there's going to be dark days too. And this is a vanity. These dark days are not fulfilling God's intended purpose like they could be as we rejoice in the days of our youth. That's what makes them vanity. When those dark days come, they're hindering our rejoicing. So verse 9 has a call to rejoice in our youth and to cheer our hearts in the days of our youth. We know in a positive sense that God will bring these things to judgment. And this should cause us to walk full tilt, rejoicing in what you've been given. I mean, this is the writer's point here, right? He's not threatening us with judgment like, you better rejoice or else God's going to judge you. He's saying, no, God's given you all this stuff. Do you think he's not going to hold you accountable for this? All these blessings he's poured upon your life day after day after day, and you're like, well, I wish I had something to rejoice about. You have plenty to rejoice about. And so he's saying, even from your youth, rejoice in these things. Enjoy life. That's the point he's calling us to. Rejoice in your youth. Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and the sight of your eyes, but know that for all these things, God's going to bring you into judgment. You have an accountability to him. So rejoice. But just remember, God's watching. So vexation should be removed. Pain put away. For youth and the dawn of life are vanity. That's how he ends in verse 10. Youth and the dawn of life are vanity. The idea is just to steward youth well. Steward your young years well. Steward the years you have right now well. I mean, no matter where you're at in this room, there's probably someone you can envision that's older than you. So this is a call for you to rejoice in your youth. You're younger than someone, right? You're still here, right? And we're just called. You might think, well, man, I really blew it when I was younger. Yeah, but you have a chance to rejoice right now. That's the writer's point. Rejoice in your youth. Use your best days to enjoy your God-given life fully. Oh, we just need to hear this, and it's so difficult to do. Because I think we've come to think that the Christian life is just this drab, God's with me. I'm going to persevere. And you know, we're just like Eeyore in Winnie the Pooh. That's, how are you doing? I'm fine. Yeah, it's cold weather. Or whatever. You know, we come up with all this stuff. And the writer's just saying, hey, rejoice. There's got to be something you can rejoice in, right? And we have the gifts. We have all kinds of gifts. And, you know, I know everybody just, you know, we have all these opinions on whether we should set up for Christmas or whatever. And it's fine. It's great. So just you people that don't think we should set up trees and stuff yet, rejoice in fall. Enjoy it. I'm not cramping your style. Enjoy this. You know, and for those of us, like next Sunday as we start setting up for Advent and preach on Advent for 4 weeks, man, it's just enjoy this. Enjoy the season. Enjoy this life that you've been given. So, a call to rejoice here. Rejoice in your youth. But there's also a call here now as we turn the corner into chapter 12 to remember our Creator. So look at how this reads in beginning in verse 1 of chapter 12. Remember also, so not only just rejoice, O man, in your youth, but also remember also your Creator in the days of your youth. Before the evil days come and the years draw near, which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain. And the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they're few. And those who look through the windows are dimmed and the doors on the house are shut. When the sound of the grinding is low and one rises up at the sound of the bird and all the daughters of the song are brought low. They're afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails because man is going to his eternal home, and the mourners go about in the streets. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. All is vanity. So a call to remember a Creator. Remember our Creator. The call of verse 1 is really to devote yourself to and worship the person who made you before it's too late. Before you no longer have any chance to rejoice in life under God's hand. Before your potential and ability to experience life and joy dry up. Rejoice. Remember your Maker. Live. Worship Him. And listen to the language. I mean, this is, you might think, what is going on there in chapter 12? Well, I think it's a poem. And it's calling us out to just kind of consider what these evil days look like. So we should devote our lives to remembering Him before evil days come, before sun and light and moon and stars are darkening and clouds return after the rain. When that day comes, keepers of the house tremble, strong men bend. It's just weird language. Grinders on the wheat mill are few. That's who the grinders are. They're the people that are pushing the mill and grinding the wheat down. They're few, so it's more work. It's heavy because why are there few? Because some have died. Some are no longer able to remember their Maker. They've returned. You know, so now the days are few. Strong men are bent, you know, in grief. Keepers of the house are trembling. Those looking out the windows are dimmed. No longer is the light. Back in verse 7, light is sweet and it's pleasant to the eyes to see the sun. Now they're looking out these windows and it's dim. It's just gray. Those singing are brought low. Doors are shut. And in verse 5, that's the reason why, right? They're afraid of what's on high and terrors are in the way. And in the midst of this, look at this in verse 5, there's an almond tree blossoming. Why is that pointed out? And we get to a grasshopper dragging and desiring failing. because death has come. Death has come. I think that awesome almond tree blossoming just speaks of God still in control in the midst of this, right? Even when death comes, God's still there. Man's going to his eternal home, and the mourners are in the streets. And in verse 6, look at all that's precious being destroyed. So you have a silver cord snapped. Gold bowls are broken. Pitchers are shattered at the fountain. So these pitchers, imagine carrying that to fill up with water for your family for the day at the fountain. And that pitcher is now broken. And the wheel is broken at the cistern. All the precious things are destroyed. Things intended for a purpose are not fulfilling it. And then in verse 7, we have kind of the uncreation of man, right? Remember how man was created? God assembled the dust and breathed life into him. And now in verse 7, it's kind of the uncreation of man. Dust to earth, and spirits return to God the Creator. Man's kind of uncreated. And so right in this moment, we return to where the book began. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. For all the joys and achievements that come with life, it will end. It's coming to an end. And this, in a sense, is the ultimate vanity. It's the ultimate vanity, death. So the preacher, you can just feel the somberness, like even in the room right now. Can't you feel that? Just, oh, man. So what are you calling me to do again? Well, he's calling us to live now. To live right now. Rejoice in your youth. Remember your Creator all the days of your earth, because there's a day coming when you won't be able to remember him. There's a day coming when you can't rejoice in him. If you want to drink deeply of the life that God's called you to enjoy, consider where it's headed. There's not going to be a day someday where, you know, after you die, you can't, like, live life to the full. Live life now. Steward your youth in light of your mortality to rejoice and remember your Maker. And then third and finally, this all ends at the epilogue. We had the call to wisdom of chapters 10 and 11. We had this exhortation to steward our youth in light of our mortality. And third and finally, it ends with this epilogue. And the point here is to hear your shepherd's wisdom. Hear your shepherd's wisdom. Verses 9 through 14. We've already read this. In verse 9, we have a review of what we've seen in this book, that being wise, we've received knowledge from this writer, from the preacher. He's taught us. These sayings have been weighed, studied, and arranged with great care for us as readers. So this wasn't just haphazardly thrown together and just like random, although to us at times it seemed like, man, I can't follow this guy's train of thought. What's going on here? No, it's saying that this was all an orderly account. It was meant to drive you to a message. And the words are filled with delight. They're morally upright. They're true. And then in verse 11, we know what that says, that wise words are often like goads or nails firmly fixed. So, right, it's the pain of being wrong. That's the nail. Most of us don't like that nail, do we? I mean, as I look across this room, I can think of different discussions I've had with many of you. Like, and you don't want to be wrong. And neither do I. Right? So it's the pain of wisdom. Wisdom is a necessary corrective so that we can live. And it's so easy to think, man, I don't want to go down that road. That'll mean I was wrong. And in that sense, wisdom's like a goad. It's like a firmly driven nail. It hurts. It's the pain of being wrong or receiving the wisdom of a goad. These are places we don't like to go very regularly. Most of us even have like positioned our lives so that we can be in places where we're the experts. And people come to us for all their problems. And so the writers we feel that, right? I think you know what I'm saying is true. Like, you know, most of us are not in jobs where it's like all up in the air. Well, I don't know. Why are you coming to me? No, most of us are in jobs where, okay, fix this. Show me how. And we do it well. That's why we're paid accordingly. And so the words of the wise are like goads, like nails firmly fixed to the collected sayings. And then we're told that they're given by one shepherd. Wisdom can be painful, but in this case, the wisdom's given by our one shepherd. By the one that we need, the one that we need to hear from. It's given by God, our shepherd. God's the origin for what we've read in this book. This wasn't just some madman's like gathering of randomness. God was communicating a message through this. And we should accept what we've been given here. There's a weird warning in verse 12. And I think it's just warning of us of the vanity of study, that we may want to study excessively. We may want to investigate things too much and avoid the joy that we've been called to. And he's saying, if you're always driven to like pursue that rather than just walking in joy, just be careful. It's a wearisome path. It leads to weariness of the flesh. And so the end of the matter, when all has been heard, is this. And here's the point that he's leading to in verses 13 and 14. First of all, to fear God and keep his commandments. This is pretty simple, right? What we need to know to live wise lives as humans is to reverence God and obey him. Revere him. Fear him. Awe him. Fear him. So, it's the whole duty of man. The essence of what being a human is all about. One writer says, it's not just our duty, it's our essence. It's the whole of everyone. And the order is significant too, right? Conduct derives from worship. He's not saying, keep your commands. And by the way, one of those commands is that you fear God. He's saying, no, fear him and keep his commandments. And that order is still important. Conduct derives from worship. A knowledge of God leads to obedience, not vice versa. Okay? So I think the order there is significant. We fear God and keep his commandments. And we do this with this final incentive in view, that every deed will be brought to judgment. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. We're accountable to this life that we've been called into by our shepherd. God's the one who's called us to this, and God's the one that we're going to give an account to. There's a writer who really helped me understand, because I was thinking like, okay, I know as a believer, though, that there's no condemnation for me in Christ Jesus. What is this talking about? There's probably some of you in this room who thought, well, I got that all figured out, yeah. So here's what I read by Sidney Gerdanis. It was really helpful. He says, God will bring every deed into judgment, including every secret thing. Nothing will be excluded. God will judge our every deed, our every word, even our every thought. In the New Testament, Jesus also said, I tell you on the day of judgment, you will have to give an account for every careless word you utter, for by your words you'll be justified, and by your words you'll be condemned. That was Matthew 12, 36 and 37. And yet, things have changed for New Testament Christians. We should keep God's commandments, not because we dread his judgment. God so loved the world that he gave his only son, so that everyone who believes in him may not perish but have eternal life. John 3, 16. On the cross, Jesus took upon himself God's judgment for sin. The penalty for sin has been paid. So dread of God's judgment is no longer a motivation to keep God's commandments. Moreover, the judge is also our Savior. Jesus said, the Father judges no one but has given all judgment to the Son. Very truly I tell you, anyone who hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life and does not come under judgment but is passed from death to life. That's John 5, 22 and 24. So God's judgment is no longer a threat for Christians. So we do not seek to keep his commandments because we dread the coming judgment. Rather, we seek to keep God's commandments because we're grateful for his grace, for saving us from that judgment. I hope that is helpful to you, because it was to me. We're not living around cowering like, oh, God's going to punish me, having kept him. No, we're completely changed. And so we awe and reverence him and keep his commandments. We're still called to keep his commandments. But we just do it now from a different motive, because we're grateful for his grace that has taken that judgment away. So now we're really freed up to keep those commandments. Walter Kaiser concluded his commentary on this book in this way. What a book! What a good God! What a life! And what a plan! Enjoy life under the sun, but prepare for life beyond the sun. That's kind of the call of this book. reverence God, and live your life here in light of Him. Doing this will show that we've heard our shepherd's wisdom. This is our shepherd's wisdom, that we would fear Him and keep His commandments. So in conclusion today, we've seen three exhortations from the preacher. The wisdom is preferable to foolishness. We're to steward our youth in light of our mortality. And then we're to hear our shepherd's wisdom. This is an amazing conclusion to this book. And these concluding exhortations call some of us, again, like I said in the introduction, to give up on the way of living that we've devoted ourselves to. Maybe you look at your life and you see that you're living in foolishness right in the moment. Like when we talk about the contrast between wisdom and foolishness, you'd think, man, I'm choosing foolishness all the time. You're not stewarding your youth well in light of death's reality coming to you someday. You're not rejoicing in Him in your youth. You're not remembering your Maker in the days of your youth. You're living for the now. The joys aren't eternal, but they're temporal. And your Maker? Well, who's He? And as for your shepherd's wisdom, you don't reverence God or obey Him, and quite honestly, at times you don't really care to. And so for you, if you live that way, judgment is surely coming. Every action and thought will be brought before Him, and you'll give an account. And while you're guilty, every single one of us in this room is guilty, there's a way of escape that we can relate to God through Jesus. That's the way of escape. It's so simple that we can turn from our sin. We can turn from all this separation. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've abandoned our shepherd. We've gone our own way. And God has laid on Jesus the iniquity of us all. So you can look to Him. You can believe in Him. You can put all your confidence for life in Him and have hope for life. There's such good news. This passage is driving us to such good news. You might think, well, judgment's coming. I guess I'm going to hell. I guess if you choose to go there, you're going to hell. But God is saying, I can have a relationship with you through my Son. Believe in me. Trust in Him. Trust in Him. Put all your confidence in Him. And you'll know eternal life. And you'll have life abundantly. Now. So that might be one strand of application that you need to walk in. And secondly, if you're a believer, these are things that are eternal for you too. Okay, so Paul famously said that to live was Christ and to die was gain. And I think he could say this in part because he got the message of Ecclesiastes. I mean, he never made that connection, so we don't know. But it seems like all that we've looked at in the book of Ecclesiastes is kind of that, right? To live is Christ and to die is gain. The joy of fearing God under the sun. That God's wisdom is preferable. That remembering our Maker and finding contentment and joy is what we have in life. And God's wisdom for us is to reverence Him and to obey Him. I mean, these are great things to walk in. It's so important for us. So again, one writer asks, why do you need to be a certain kind of employee? Because you have to fear God and keep His commandments. Why do you have to be a certain kind of child? Because you fear God and know that He wants you to honor your parents. Everything I do for you, I do because I do it for God, first and foremost. That's the kind of person Ecclesiastes is teaching me I ought to be. Perhaps if we were thinking of doing everything for God, first and foremost, it would quite radically change what we do for one another. It might make us bolder in what we say, more concerned for God's truth than one another's approval. It might make us more kind and more gentle, realizing that God's commanded us to forgive one another as He forgave us. It will make us more joyful, less grumpy, and more generous. It will make us more alive. This book calls us deeper into the truest of all realities, that we could live before God. That's the truest of all realities, the life that we live before God. So let's reverence God. Let's fear Him. Let's esteem God foremost in our hearts and demonstrate that we're a people who glorify and enjoy Him forever.